This is Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. In 2010, Sister Simone Campbell got widespread attention for organizing her Nuns on the Bus tour. She and her fellow sisters traversed the country, raising awareness for social justice. The good news is that Sister Simone is still going strong. The bad news is that she needs to. She joins us to talk about her new book. From there, Red Sox Nation's most ardent member, Doris Kearns Goodwin, sits down to talk about her other big passion, history.
From there, it's Harvard historian Nancy Kane on capitalism. Could income inequality undo the global economy? If cryogenics and the Ted Williams tunnel are all you know about one of baseball's giants, Ben Bradley Jr. will fill in the blanks by way of his new biography of Ted Williams. That's coming up on Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. Today we're replaying a series of conversations we've had over the past year. We begin with Sister Simone Campbell, the religious leader, lawyer, and poet who most of us know as the Nun on the Bus, a woman who raises social awareness by way of cross-country trips with her fellow sisters. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. In 2010, Sister Simone Campbell got widespread attention for organizing her Nuns on the Bus tour. She and her fellow sisters traveled across the country in opposition to Paul Ryan's budget, which would have drastically cut federal funding for safety net programs for the poor. The good news is Sister Simone is still going strong, and then some. The bad news is that she still needs to. What brings her here today is her new terrific book, A Nun on the Bus. Sister Simone, it's great to see you. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
Nice to see you in person. We all saw you at the Democratic National Convention on the stage giving a speech. So you are the chief nun of the Nuns on the Bus. How did the Nuns on the Bus whole thing come to be? Explain to people.
Well, I say it was the Holy Spirit, because in 2012, when the Vatican censure came out against the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, the censure listed us, Network, our little organization with 9 full-time staff, the Vatican said was a bad influence on Catholic sisters in the United States. And I knew very quickly that I could talk to the press because we're not created by the Vatican, mm-hmm. but the Leadership Conference had to be careful. But I got bored. It's never about us. It's never about Catholic sisters. It's always about our mission. So my prayer was, how do we use this moment for mission? And what came to me in prayer was to invite help. And we had a meeting May 14th, and after an hour and a half meeting, we were going on the road. Mm-hmm. And then, as they say, the rest was history. It was an explosion of opportunity.
How'd you come up with the term Nuns on the Bus, please?
Oh, that was an accident, actually. We were joking around about it at the office. That's what we called it while we thought of a good title, a serious title. So we finally picked a serious title. Was Nuns Drive for Faith, Family, and Fairness. But our designer thought that was a tagline, not the name.
Yeah.
And so she sent back a design that had Nuns on the Bus. Drive for Faith, Family, and Fairness. And it was just perfect. So we had to laugh and say, that's it.
By the way, while you have done wonderful things, we're going to talk about some of them, and your campaigns are just needed and terrific. How horrible is bus travel? Can we agree? Is there anything worse than being stuck on a bus, even with friends and colleagues? And...
Well, it's a serious challenge. It's a serious challenge. The way we survived, however, and it became a place of joy, was that every morning we would meet for a half-hour meditation and prayer, and we would join together in prayer. About the second or third day of the first trip, we thought we would sleep in because we were exhausted and that we would pray on the bus. Well, we never got around to praying on the bus. And by noon, we were gnawing on each other. We were just grumpy and grouchy. So we never missed prayer after that. And I think prayer really helped see us through. So.
Is your sense that you're making headway? I mean, you're getting a huge amount of play, both because I would argue the cause is just and because you're a terrific spokesperson for the cause.
Thanks.
But my cynical attitude is... The vast majority of Americans, when there's economic strife, understandably care about their own situation, don't care about poor people. You will almost never hear a politician mention poor people. They're fighting for working people, for them. I know a lot of working
the
people.
The ladders of prosperity.
The middle class, fighting for the middle class. You're fighting, talk about going upstream. I mean, this is almost the worst time, it seems to me, to try to convince people because it just... Poor people don't matter to so many.
But here's the thing. People do care. They're just so frightened themselves that they get locked up in their own lives and feel like they're scrambling to hold on. But what I've discovered is if people feel like we're standing together, we have each other's backs, then they can relax and they do care about each other. It's about being community, that we've gotten so individualistic. And if I'm the only one taking care of me, then yeah, I am not going to care about anybody else. But the fact is, we in this amazing nation are a democracy. And what that's supposed to be about is us caring for each other. Then it makes a difference.
We're talking with Simone Campbell. She's the nun, chief nun from Nuns.
Chief nun.
From the Nuns on the Bus campaign. We were just talking before you came about Elizabeth Warren, who's our United States Senator here, and her whole shtick, which is about, I shouldn't say it's a shtick, I think she really believes it, but her whole deal about, you know, income inequality and the middle class getting hammered. She's not talking that much about poor people, but she is talking about the middle class who are sliding into poverty in many cases. And my sense is that's part of the reason Warren has caught on, at least in certain quarters, because of her emphasis on the rich getting richer, the poor getting poorer. So does that fit in? I mean, you're talking more about...
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
It does.
I mean, it really is, because we do this thing. The thing that we stand up for is the 100%. And there's this fabulous book, Spirit Level, that points out where you have greater and greater income disparity and wealth disparity between the top and the bottom. Everybody has a lower quality of life. Everybody suffers in some way because of lower education, because of the lack of investment in our infrastructure, because of the healthcare problems. All of these reasons, we all suffer if there's this huge disparity. And the fact is, we need to pay attention to those who are struggling to the bottom, as well as the folks in the middle that are just trying to make a go of it. But we're in this together. And when we know that, which I believe she does, then that catches hold. That catches fire.
So, Sister Simone, can I continue to be negative for a little while?
Oh, yeah,
and then you'll deliver me from that in a few minutes?
I'll try to.
And it surely is not because I don't want you to succeed. There was a story, I think it was in the New York Times, maybe in the Globe, pretty sure in the New York Times, after Pope Francis started talking about income inequality and poverty, and I mean started high profile, obviously, that first trip to Brazil and his whole career there has been about income inequality. But when he made it center stage, someone wrote an article that I think was more hopeful than prescient, that this is going to put a lot of pressure on American politicians who are generally not very favorably disposed to worrying about the plight of poor people, to all of a sudden say, well, if our or one of the world's great religious leaders cares about this, maybe I would. I'm still waiting for the first person to say they had an epiphany. They read the words of Pope Francis, and Pope Francis is right. While we can differ on X, Y, and Z, right and left in this country have got to come together to make sure that poor people have a chance. Have you seen any movement amongst people in elective office on this thing since the Pope has done what he's done?
Well, I work at Congress. I lobby in Congress. And what we did a couple weeks ago was to do a briefing on Capitol Hill about what the Pope's saying. Mm. And just trying to let people know that it's a challenge for both Democrats, because what Pope Francis says is that it is not about the safety net, but it's about changing our economy. And it's a challenge for Republicans, because what he says is that trickle-down economics never worked, was never proven, and is not the Christian way forward. And so we tried to put it in that context, that it's a stretch to conversion for all of us. There are some people using more words, but I haven't really seen any actions yet. But, hey, it's only been a year.
Was it a bipartisan gathering at the thing you did, though? Well, that's good.
But here's where I think it's significant, what Pope Francis says, is because, you know, the joke is, and I'm a Catholic, the joke is the bishops have all become Republicans about 25 years ago, and the nuns are the only ones who are, you know, when you think of the classic Democrat, all this together kind of thing. And so you see things in the Catholic Church in America that's changing, you know, attitudes. I mean, we saw Wilton Gregory, that he had to get rid of his the Archbishop, where is he?
Yes.
In Alabama or someplace or other. I forget where
Georgia.
He is. Georgia. Thank
Atlanta.
You. Close, down the south somewhere. Had to give up his extravagant house. And you see people, you hear people, attitudes changing among the hierarchy a little bit. And when I was growing up, you thought of the Catholic Church as always about poor people's issues, always. And then in the last 20 or 30 years, it's all become abortion, abortion, gay rights, abortion, abortion, gay rights, gay rights. So I'm hopeful about that impact, that the Catholic Church will reclaim its kind of role on poor people's issues. But maybe I'm being too naive and idealistic.
I think it's coming. And the way we saw the difference was on our first bus trip in 2012, we, because of the censure and because of that fear of our leadership in that time within the Catholic Church. We couldn't meet on any parish property. We only met in Catholic sisters' convents or schools or this kind of thing, or other churches, like we were at the UCC place, or the Unitarians hosted us, the Lutherans, that kind of thing. But on our second tour, we had, last summer, after Pope Francis was elected, we had five different bishops come to five different events, and we could be on church property. It was hugely different, and I think one of the big things that Pope Francis is doing is freeing people from their fear, including our bishops. Our bishops have been so afraid of each other and of getting turned in that this has freed them to have their own thoughts and not look over their shoulders.
Well, tell us another fascinating story. You talk about it in your book, and if people don't know this, that the nuns were in one place, not just you, but a lot of American nuns were in one place on so-called Obamacare.
Absolutely.
And the bishops were in another place. Oh. You were on opposite sides.
Yes.
Explain that to people.
Well, what happened was the Catholic Health Association was trying to work with the bishops' conference to get a unified position on the Affordable Care Act, and the bishops' staff was dragging their feet. So finally, Sister Carol Keehan from the Catholic Health Association comes out with her statement.
Who runs it.
And she comes out, a daughter of charity, a fabulous woman. She comes out in favor. And I immediately email her and saying, "Dear Carol, we're standing with you. We'll be right there." And then what happens is we put our statement up. Then I go to meditation. I'm doing my meditation. I was in California. And so it was the morning. I was praying. And what came to me is we could do, very distractedly praying. And what came to me was that we could do a sign-on letter. And so I sent the sign-on letter to various friends in my contacts, and we ended up with 59 Catholic sisters, leaders of their communities, signing on to affirm the Affordable Care Act. But between the time I sent it out and the time we released it, the bishops came out opposing it. The bishop's staff gave them very bad advice. And this is the horror of it. The bishop's staff told the bishops that there was a federal funding for abortion in the Affordable Care Act, and that's why they opposed it. But the fact is, two federal courts have found as a matter of law, that means without question, there is no federal funding of abortion in the Affordable Care Act. And finally, about a year and a half after it became law, the bishop's staff finally changed their website to say not that there was federal funding of abortion, but they changed it to say that they feared that there was federal funding of abortion. I mean, getting hijacked on that issue gave the bishops really bad advice. But it also became quite an international event, which is why we got named in the censure, really, is that, as one of the sisters who signed said, "Well, the girls played the boys. And for once, the girls won." And so, I mean, that's really what happened.
By the way, that's what she said. I want you to know. Mark Regan said those exact same things at the time.
What is the status, by the way, Sister Simone, of the Vatican investigation of the nuns? Is that still going on? Because I was hoped. So Pope Francis is not put the kibosh on that. Well, that's not good.
No, but we have to realize that, one, the Holy Spirit has used this moment to bring up the issues of poverty. And, I mean, we've gotten more press than we would ever have in our whole lives. And so the Holy Spirit is using this moment. So while it's painful, it does continue. The second thing is, this week in Rome, our leadership from the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, they are there. They're meeting with all the various different offices. They'll meet with the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith. And it is expected that in the fall, they're going to release the report on the visitation. There's actually two investigations that have been going on, competing investigations. So they both continue. And we continue to do our mission.
By the way, let me just say, for those who just tuned in, this is the voice of Sister Simone Campbell. Her new book is called A Nun on the Bus. My apologies, Marjorie.
That's okay. The reason for the investigation was supposedly that you espouse too many radical feminist views.
I know.
So if they decide that you do espouse too many radical feminist views over there in the Vatican, what does that mean practically that the nuns will have to do?
Well, that's the big mystery, is that what they could do is, the worst they could do is disband the leadership Conference of Women Religious, or they could say that we all have to toe some line, and then we all get to decide what we do. I mean, we'll see. The fact is, I really think that Pope Francis is doing the important work of reforming the Curia at the very top level, and we're getting in trouble. We got in trouble for doing the very things that he's doing, that he's saying about women need a better place in the church. Women need to be involved in decision making. We need to, you know, bring in the people that abortion and gay marriage is not the only issue the church cares about. So, I mean, I'm going to use him for my footnote in my brief if I have to defend myself.
Are you as relentlessly positive as you appear? I mean, you and Marjorie have been watching for the last few minutes, have been discussing what, to me, if I did what you have chosen to do with your life, would be really dispiriting. when you're fighting the cause that your whole church should be fighting.
Absolutely.
And, I mean, how does that affect you as a human? I mean, how hard is it? When, for example, when that censure came down, what was it like for you?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, it was like a sock in the stomach. It was like shocking. 9 full-time staff makes the Vatican nervous. I mean, you know, it's like, what? But the other piece is, as a person of faith, though, and dedicated to the Holy Spirit, my community is dedicated to the Holy Spirit. And so the Spirit uses everything. You have to know, 4 days before the censure, we celebrated 40 years of network, my organization, doing lobbying on Capitol Hill. It was fabulous. But the big question was, how do we get our message out? How do we let people know what we're doing?
Yeah, how you get your message out? Yeah, people like Sean Hannity talk about you. This is a quote. I've been waiting to play this.
Oh, you've
this
been
is
excited for this
Sean
one.
Hannity. Well, you'll just listen. It's self-explanatory.
What the book's about is trying to lift up the needs of low-income people in our nation, and the fact that we, the people of the United States,
but
are missing
big,
it.
Big, going after
but there
Paul
was,
Ryan's
there
budget.
There was Paul Ryan's budget. Was
that was the big
thing.
So you're a communist.
No, not at all.
Now, was that said, it sounds like a little laughter in his voice. Was there laughter in, there wasn't. That was a serious kind of.
They cut a whole bunch that followed that, where he kept repeating.
He said the same thing over and over?
Then you're a communist. Then you're a communist. Which was like, oh, my glory, give me a break. No. I believe that we should share what we have. I am a Christian, but.
Anyway. Well, you know what I find fascinating about this? Because you have these guys like Paul Ryan, who talks about what a serious Catholic he is.
Oh, I know.
And now, in the last election, that was before Pope Francis came, and Pope Francis started talking all about the poor and stuff. So Ryan and people, you know, the term cafeteria Catholics, you have to be down with the church in every single solitary thing, you're not a real Catholic. It seems to me the Francis effect and people like you and the nuns on the bus talking about these economic inequality issues does put the supposed super Catholic Paul Ryan in a difficult place.
I hope so. And that's my goal. And we were trying to get a meeting with him, and his scheduler said, oh, I'm sorry, he's not prepared to meet with you yet.
Huh.
So I keep trying.
Have you met him to date?
I met him after the first bus trip and tried to talk to him about the substance of the issues, but he did not want to connect on the stories of real people.
Sister Simone, how do you deal with what it seems to me is obviously got to be a difficult issue for you, namely abortion, because a lot of poor women would say it's one of the critical, our right to choose is sort of critical to freedom, our economic independence, our personal independence. So how do you reconcile all that with your faith and the needs of poor women? What do you do about that?
Well, I am pro-life. I believe that all life is sacred. But the way to support women in choosing life is to give them the supports that they need, to give them economic care. France has a much more liberal abortion law than we do, but it has a lower abortion rate because they support women. Women get a year's paid leave from their job to care for their children. They get low-cost daycare. They get medical care. When you have structures for women in place, women do not choose abortion. That is the way forward. That's what I believe. I'm actually both pro-life and pro-choice because women are desperate, and desperate women do desperate things. And I know the time when women would go to back alleys and end up seriously infected, sick, dying because of botched abortions. That's wrong, too. That is wrong, too.
We're talking with Sister Simone Campbell. She is the chief nun from Nuns on the Bus. Is it Nuns? It is Nuns on the Bus,
It is Nuns on the Bus. The book is A Nun.
A Nun on the
it's
Bus.
It's just me.
Okay. It's just you in the cover in a fetching red dress.
Actually, there's five of us, if you see on the cover. There's various nuns.
There's several other nuns.
Multiple
nuns.
There's multiple nuns. Correct.
But the story is A Nun.
You know, there was a big canonization yesterday in Rome, of course. John Paul II was canonized, and so was John the 23rd. I thought it was interesting in a way, because I'm old enough to remember the changes that Vatican II brought about when John the 23rd became the Pope. And as many people may know, he was supposed to be the caretaker Pope. And suddenly he's calling this, this big assembly known as Vatican II. That Francis, in many ways, reminds me of John the 23rd, because John the 23rd talked a lot about these poverty issues. John the 23rd snuck out in the middle of the night in Rome to run around meeting with Romans, and he went to prisons and so forth. What's your take on the canonization of John the 23rd, and that Francis apparently insisted upon it. He wasn't going to just have John Paul II canonized without John the 23rd. So what does that mean, do you think?
Well, I thought it was very astute politically within church politics to reverence both of them. I have a favorite, John the 23rd.
Yeah, me too.
But there was something for everyone. But I think the piece that you touch on about how Francis is like John the 23rd is really important because to a hungry world, he brings hope. He brings a pastoral presence. He understands the suffering of folks. And touching the pain of the world releases hope into the darkness. And that is such a... personally, I did not realize how desperate I was for a pastoral word from our leadership. And it is such a comfort to my heart. And I know it is for hundreds of people, not even Catholics. I've had people tell me, oh, I'm basically an atheist, but I like your Pope.
Okay, so last thing for me, Sister Simone Campbell, author of A Nun on the Bus. Actually, she is the nun on the bus about whom she speaks. Tell me why I should be optimistic about the next decade, that your message is going to break through and there will be greater opportunity and support for people at the bottom of the economic ladder in this country. Why is it going to change?
Well, I think the reason for hope is that we can engage with each other. I think it is really in doubt which way this is going to go. I think the economy needs to be changed dramatically. I think we've got to step back to being about the common good. But it's in the conversation. We're having this conversation now, which is something that did not happen a couple of years ago. So I take that as a good sign. We'll ooze our way forward. But as long as we're in community, as long as I do it because of faith, but where we meet is in the Constitution, we the people of the United States. It's not we the politicians or we the rich guys or we the ones who can buy all those political ads. It's we the people. And if we the people stand up, hey, we're fine. We'll be great.
She's got me.
Oh, cool. Stand together.
Sister Simone, it's great to meet you and great to talk to you.
Sister
Thanks so
much. Simone Campbell's new book is A Nun on the Bus. It's a great, fun read and great to have you with us here today, Sister. Up next, we're going back to the 20th century by way of Doris Kearns Goodwin's latest book, The Bully Pulpit, A Look at Teddy Roosevelt, William Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just joining us, we're replaying some of the best conversations we've had over the year. A few months ago, one of the most devoted members of Red Sox Nation, that's Doris Kearns Goodwin, dropped by to talk about her other passion, American history. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. In the introduction to her latest terrific book, Doris Kearns Goodwin writes, quote, "There are but a handful of times in the history of our country where there occurs a transformation so remarkable that a molt seems to take place and an altered country begins to emerge. It's certainly true of the era that she writes about in The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. What is not in her introduction, though, is reciprocity. In famed anchorman Ron Burgundy's groundbreaking autobiography, in his author's note, he writes, and I quote, "It took me 8 years to write this book. The research alone, the fact-checking, reading the source materials, asking questions was endless. I didn't care for it that much. I consulted with my dear friend and lover, Doris Kearns Goodwin, over many breakfasts in bed." You know, we thought it was just coincidence. Yeah. Marjorie and I did that Ron Burgundy and Doris were in downtown Boston at the same time. Obviously, it wasn't. Doris, congratulations on the relationship and the book. It's really great news. How are you, Doris?
One is nonfiction, one is fiction. But the second one is lots of fun. That's what she says. Of course, that's what she'll say.
I think it's so wonderful that Ron Burgundy, Will Ferrell, would mention you and talk, you know, even though
that
he
is
was
pretty
joking.
Great.
I mean,
no,
be
it's
pretty
really
impressed.
Funny. I mean, he has also in their lines, you know, that she was my lover and she had more energy than I did, and I couldn't keep up with her. And if she wants another bounce, she can come along. So there's lots of my friends
she
who
wants
think,
another bounce.
Another bounce.
I love
so
that.
Some of my friends think this is my greatest achievement, to be his fictional lover.
It's pretty funny. And the movie, have you ever seen the movie? The movie
it's got a cult following.
Oh,
so
God. I just love it. Very funny. So tell us about the book. You know, Jim explained a lot of it, but what's the thesis? You know, the bully pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, the golden age of journalism. What's the thesis here, Doris Kearns Goodwin?
Oh, that's a great question. I haven't been asked that for so long. I feel like I'm back in school. I love it.
Okay. Well, the takeaway or the point.
That question.
No, I love the question. Oh, okay. I think it's great. No, I think what it is that what was needed to be done at the turn of the 20th century when there was a huge gap between the rich and the poor, when there was no workman's compensation, when there was no government regulation of industry and trusts and monopolies forming everywhere, was some sort of action. And Theodore Roosevelt understood that the only way he could get the action done was by pressuring the Congress, which was an old guard Congress who wanted nothing to do with government regulation, to pressure them to bring the bills to the floor. And the only way he could do that was to make use of the bully pulpit. He's the one that defined the word as the platform a president has to educate the country. And the only way he could do that was to have a relationship with the press. And his relationship with the press is the most remarkable I've ever written about. They were his friends. They were productive, and yet they retained their integrity, and he retained his.
You know, the image that you write, tell the story about how press, the primary access, and there were lots of different, one primary access that the press had to Teddy Roosevelt when he was doing what, Doris Kearns Goodwin?
Well, every day the barber would shave him in the middle of the day. And it's a straight edge, razor.
Yeah.
So he's sitting in the chair. The press are all invited in to ask questions. And evidently the barber had to be a magician because Teddy's moving around talking to the press. And they have freedom to talk. Then at night when he's signing mail, they come in again. They come to lunch. They go to Sagamore Hill. He really respected writers because he was a writer. And he understood that in order for that relationship to work, he had to accept their criticism. For example, there's a famous moment when one of these great journalists who wrote Mr. Dooley, this famous character in humorist history, wrote a review of Teddy's Rough Rider book. And he said that Teddy made himself the center of attention so much that he should have called the book Alone in Cuba. So everybody's mocking Teddy, reading the book. And he writes him back and he said, I regret to tell you that my entire family is delighted with your review of my book. Now you owe it to come and visit me. I've always wanted to make your acquaintance. That's inconceivable today, that kind of thick enough skin to be able to take that criticism.
Well, not only thick enough skin, we read last week that photographers are filing complaints against the Obama White House. You know, forget a coverage and access. You can't even take pictures of the president anymore. They have an official photographer who then tweets out or whatever they do, photographs. So the contrast in access. How did he make the calculation that he could use, or use is probably a poor choice of words, maybe it isn't, work with, cooperate with the press to essentially pressure this government to reform itself?
Well, I think he knew that there was a group of reporters then who are now still famous in the history of journalism. Ida Tarbell, Lincoln Steffens, Ray Baker, William Allen White. I mean, they're the honored reporters. They were all at one magazine at the same time. And he understood that they were creating stories. People respond to stories, right? He needs to do something about the monopolies, but it's pretty abstract. What is a trust? What is a monopoly? Ida Tarbell writes a story showing how Standard Oil had used illegal means to get its monopoly position. And suddenly the country says, I understand that now through the person. Ray Baker writes about railroad abuses. And they finally understand it. Lincoln Steffens writes about corruption in the city. And so he knows that they are able to tell in larger fashion what he can only shorthand tell. And he values their work. So he reads proofs of their articles ahead of time, sends them his messages ahead of time. And it worked for both sides.
We're talking with Doris Kearns Goodwin, the author of many books. The newest one is The Bully Pulpit. You also talk, though, about the time that these journalists had to prepare their pieces and investigate their pieces and the length of the pieces. Tell people about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard again to imagine today. I mean, McClure understood that they had to be fact-based and really impregnable pieces to have an impact.
So he would give them sometimes 2 years as a staff reporter. He almost invented the concept of staff reporter before they had to write a word. And then their pieces would come out, stretching over 12 monthly issues, 50,000 words sometimes these pieces were. I mean, that's the problem today. Who would have the resources to give reporters that time for their investigations? And then even if they did report it, who's going to read that?
And everybody, people were salivating over these pieces then, were they not?
Absolutely. It became the common conversation in the country.
And now we have, most of the public, and I include myself, have the attention span of gnats. And is that because there were so few competing distractions? Is that what it was?
No TVs.
This is what you're waiting for, the next Steffens piece?
No, I think you're absolutely right. Print journalism was at its heyday then, right? It's before the radio, it's before television, it's before the internet. And so people were reading a lot more in all sorts of means, reading books even more and reading print journals. And magazines with their new drawings, cartoons became so popular. And then people would talk. They'd talk at their local store about what they just read. And that's where the pressure could build up to deal with Congress.
Tell the story. I think it was Steffens, but if I'm wrong, obviously you'll correct me. Who was the person who got the note from Roosevelt?
It is Steffens.
That he was, tell this unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, and you compare this as one does to everything that is happening now. Obviously you can't resist, and I know you know that. But tell the story about what Roosevelt gave to Steffens.
So Steffens starts by studying corruption in the cities, and he writes the famous series of called The Shame of the Cities. Then he starts and deals with corruption at the state level, and lots of governors get undone because of what he writes. So then he decides, well, I want to study if there's corruption in the federal government. So he goes to Roosevelt, and Roosevelt gives him a note that gives him permission to talk to anybody as long as it's the truth that he's being told. And he carries that thing around him to
from
go
the
and study.
From the President of the United States. Not the press secretary, from the President.
No, exactly. And Steffens and Roosevelt fought like cats and dogs. So it wasn't like this was one of his partisans. He would think Steffens was unrealistic. He eventually became sort of a socialist. He never thought he was the right kind of understanding of politics, but he respected the idea that if you find out something wrong in the federal government, even if you're the head of it, it's good for you to find that out.
Well, I don't want to move away from olden times too quickly, but I just have to ask you, because the bully pulpit is something that many presidents think they have, but we have one now that has been criticized left and right for not using it. So is he not using it, or are we not listening?
Well, wait a second. Before you answer that, he actually used it yesterday. He used it yesterday in a speech talking about what the major challenge was for the remaining 3 years in office. Let's hear a couple of seconds from the President of the United States. Here it is.
This increasing inequality is most pronounced in our country. And it challenges the very essence of who we are as a people. I believe this is the defining challenge of our time.
Okay, income inequality was a big issue back in Roosevelt and Taft's day as well. But I wanted to ask you about that question about the bully pulpit. Is he talking and we're not listening? Combination of both? What do you think? I mean, you've written about FDR, you've written about Lincoln, you're commenting on presidential politics all the time. What do you think?
Well, the interesting thing is, I think one of the things Teddy Roosevelt understood was that you had to talk in shorthand language. You had to make things crystal clear. So he would have these little sayings like the square deal or speak softly and carry a big stick. And people got it because he knew that you had to make headlines. But also his speeches would be printed in full in the newspaper. It's the first day of national newspapers, right? The first era. By the time Roosevelt comes, FDR, the radio, 80% of the people are listening to him on the radio. No interruptions. Saul Bellow said you could walk down the street and watch everybody in their little houses watching what he was doing, listening to the same voice. The early days of television up till Reagan, three networks, you're listening to the whole speech. Look what happens now. He makes a speech like yesterday. You may just watch your favorite cable network. You may not hear the whole speech. You may hear the pundits criticizing it before it's even begun. But most importantly, to go back to what you said, our attention span is such that it's going to be breaking news tomorrow, and you don't have that sustained conversation anymore. So I think it's partly the institution has been diminished now, but it's still a incredibly important tool for a president, and I think he has to use it on health care right now.
The institution of the presidency has been diminished.
No, I don't mean the whole presidency, but I mean the bully pulpit
okay,
part
the bully
of it.
Pulpit part
yeah.
of it.
But how does he – let's just stay on that for a second. You mentioned he has to use it on health care. When I read the headline when I woke up the other day, I think it was 2 days ago, and it said Barack Obama going to start a relentless campaign explaining – the health care law that passed 34 months or 32 months ago, I thought it was the Barowitz report or something. It was just, for those who know, great satirical blogger, a genius, I should say. How can someone so smart not get it? Is it that he doesn't get it, that, as people say, he has contempt for both the press and for anybody who's not his wife or Valerie Jarrett? What is it? And I'm serious. What is it that causes him not to get that he's such an engaging human being and such a great teacher as he was? So teach.
I mean, it had to be done from day one. I mean, there's no question that he lost the battle for what the health care bill was all about in that summer of the town hall meetings, even before the bill passed.
Sarah Palin was doing a better job of disinformation than he was of information.
Exactly. She creates the metaphor, or whoever does, of death panels. And that was just a shorthand phrase that Teddy Roosevelt would say was a good phrase, even though it's on the opposite side, even though it may not have been factually true. So even before the health care bill passed, he did finally give a good speech to the joint session of Congress about the health care law before it passed. But then that's when Joe Wilson, the congressman, stood up and said, you lie. And that became the story. But there's been months that he has to explain this thing. Now, maybe if he breaks it down into the component parts, which are popular, I gather, from the polls, people will be able to understand, yes, I like this part of it. And even if I don't know what the whole big thing is all about.
We're talking with Doris Kearns Goodwin, whose new book is The Bully Pulpit. You started out to be doing something focusing on Roosevelt and the progressive era, and then it expanded into William Howard Taft. And I'm embarrassed to say I know next to nothing about William Howard Taft until I finished reading your book, except that he was enormous. So why the expansion to Taft?
So to speak.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Hey, excellent.
Well, you do go into his diet.
Yeah, well,
everything.
No, I know. He was 250 at Yale. He was 250 as Supreme Court Chief Justice, but 350 during his presidential years. So his weight was a problem. But I think what happened to me is what happens in every book. I choose these presidents who are the most written about presidents because I want to live with them. I'm going to take so long with them. And I can't just write about them because I'll just be doing what a lot of other people have done. So Lincoln becomes Team of Rivals. FDR becomes Franklin and Eleanor. And I was looking for how can I expand the cast of characters in this book. And I knew, honestly, not as much more than you did about Taft. I knew he succeeded him. I knew they ran against each other. And I knew he was fat. But then when I started reading the letters between the two of them, because I got interested in him and saw that they'd been such close friends before they broke apart in 1912 and that he'd been a critical part of Teddy's cabinet, then I said, well, hey, maybe I'll make him a character. And then he got more interesting to me. I felt more admiration for him. And he may have failed as a public leader, but he was a really decent, amiable, good guy.
What did you admire most?
I think I admired mostly that he was a person that when people met him, they trusted him. Teddy himself said of Taft that he envied his personality because people loved him at first sight, and where it took longer for Teddy to get into the hearts of people. And he was the best number two man. I mean, that was the problem for him in business leadership. He was perfect at every position as long as he had someone in charge because he didn't like the public spotlight. So when he became president, he felt like he was a fish out of water.
Well, you know, you say that. I'll tell you what I like best about him, that he was, because he was not the leader, as you write, that Roosevelt was. This quote is so great. When I hear someone say, Mr. President, this is Taft when he is president, I look around expecting to see Roosevelt. I mean, how great and self-whatever. It's just such a great moment.
Well, since many of us are battling weight issues, how did he lose the 100 pounds post-surgery?
Well, he was on a diet that was,
the Atkins
diet. Was almost like the Atkins diet. I mean, it was no carbohydrates and drinking lots of water. And then he had to change all of his clothes, and he had to go to the trousers, you know, and he had them all taken in. But then he started eating again, and it came all the way back. And then finally at the end, I think when he was happy, the interesting thing is when he was happy at Yale, when he was happy as Chief Justice, he was at 250, which was fine for his build. When he was unhappy and feeling nervous in the political world, he was never meant for politics.
Yeah,
temperament is the separator.
An emotional eater, perhaps.
An emotional eater,
yeah,
indeed.
So you know what you obviously read a lot because you're an author. But I am always amazed when I hear, like, Roosevelt having written 40 books and then writing these voluminous letters 2 and 3 times a week to his closest friends. I know they weren't watching television, but I mean, a lot of us don't watch that much television. We still don't have time. How did they do this?
No, it astonishes me, too. I mean, Roosevelt read a book every moment he could. He was waiting for a visitor. He was reading part of it. He's waiting for his wife to come down for dinner. He's reading more of it. And he said that for a leader, books and poetry and philosophy are so important to understand human nature that you can only get it best from books and from, you know, from the great imaginative writers. And even there was one time he was in the middle of a coal strike, the most formidable industrial challenge. He brought the capitalists and the labor guys together for the first time in the White House area. And he was reading a book on the Mediterranean races in the middle of it because he needed to just relax and replenish his energies. But I think for all of them then, the print medium was the major means of communication. There's no telephone. They have to write to one another. They learn to write in ways that we may not be doing anymore.
How fast can you read a 200-page novel, Doris Kearns Goodwin?
I'm not that fast of a reader, to be honest.
Good.
In fact, at night when I go to bed, I read mysteries, so I can just read 20 pages and then go to sleep.
Who's your favorite mystery writer?
Well, finally somebody gave me Sherlock Holmes, so I would sound a little more classy when I was asked that question because I knew it. But I love Mary Higgins Clark, and I love Elizabeth George, and even Margaret Truman, you know, Death in the White House. Yeah. I read her.
You know what's mortifying for me? Well, you two are having a highbrow discussion about authors. I am rereading the author's note that Ron Burgundy wrote. I'm sorry to do this, to ruin this otherwise wonderful discussion. Although we are no longer lovers. He's talking about Doris. This is Ron Burgundy. Because I don't know why, he says. Her knowledge of presidential history is the basis for Chapter 12. Her dogged enthusiasm for the project was only outpaced by her enthusiasm for lovemaking, which I could barely... Fairly equal.
That's
that is so
she wore him
funny.
Out on Burgundy on the
so
set.
What's the takeaway? You know, when I was reading the thing about his relationship with the press and letting them in, and the note to Steffens, you say to yourself, or a reader says to himself, I said to myself, God, there's got to be something transferable here. But then I say to myself, well, maybe there's potential for co-option. There's potential for manipulation. Obviously, you can never go back to that. What's a takeaway? If Barack Obama was sitting there and said, I know I have a horrible relationship with the press. I know Roosevelt, at least in the beginning, did it exactly the other way. Okay, Doris Kearns Goodwin, what do I take from Roosevelt and do now to fix this mess I find myself in?
I think what you take away from that is that in a democracy, even though the press is going to criticize you, you need them because they're the channel to the public, and especially in a country like ours. FDR had twice a week press conferences. Think about that. He, too, had a good relationship with the press. It's not a coincidence that Teddy and FDR were popular as a result of that. And I would say to President Obama, just have them in there more. Just know that it's going to be difficult, but they need you and you need them. And unless the country sees, you know, that partnership working somewhat more productively without co-optation, you've lost a huge element of your power.
You know,
seduce a few choice reporters, and you could
like any good politician does at any level.
I mean, Bill Weld did that in Massachusetts; had all the reporters up there to the
statehouse for beers on Fridays.
It was Amber Liquid as well.
You know, Doris, when we talked to you about Team of Rivals at our prior radio station, one of the things I asked you is the same thing we asked Ben Bradley the other day about Ted Williams, which is. Did you feel like you knew Lincoln after the decade of doing this? And I know two-thirds of a decade here. When you're immersed in this and you're alone doing your research and writing, do you feel like Roosevelt or Taft are with you or that you know them or they're college? You know what I'm trying?
Oh, I do. Without a question. I mean, you're waking up with them every morning. You're reading their materials every day. You're reading private journals. You're reading diary entries. There's nothing like a handwritten letter as a historian looking back 100 years ago and seeing what the person said at the end of a day. In fact, the first time I saw the Lincoln movie at Spielberg's house, an early cut of it, I just thought when I saw Daniel Day-Lewis, oh, my God, this is the Lincoln I thought I knew. I mean, he walks like we knew Lincoln walked. All we knew then was that he walked like a laborer coming home at the end of a hard day, that he had a high-pitched voice, and Daniel had that high-pitched voice. And it was just miraculous for me to see in three dimension the person that I knew in my head, in my imagination. So the whole movie thing was so much fun, and Spielberg's bought the rights to this one.
Oh, is that so?
Yeah. Fantastic.
So, well, we talked in the making of that movie about Teddy and Taft, so he read it in manuscript, and so it really will be fun.
Is Chris Christie going to play Taft? That is so – I take that back, by the way.
Alrighty.
I'm really sorry. I apologize in advance.
Well,
don't send an email.
As long as you said that about Chris Christie, Jim Browdy has given many speeches in his life, and I've heard a lot of them. And
I don't think
I've ever been to a speech he's given where he hasn't used the line from Alice Longworth Roosevelt, or Roosevelt Longworth, excuse me.
You know what the line is?
Yeah, what's the line?
If you don't have anything good to say about anybody, come sit right next to me. One of the greats ever.
But you do talk a little bit about Alice in the book, The Child of the Marriage. The wife died right after childbirth, his first wife. What was her first
name? Alice was her name. That's why they named the daughter Alice.
And then he married Edith after that. But tell us a little bit about this character. She was really something.
Oh, no, she was something. I mean, it was a hard life for her in some ways because her mother died, and he had loved Teddy had loved the mother so much that he never wanted to talk about her again. It was an odd way to deal with death. And so she grew up not knowing much about her mother. Edith is a good stepmother, but still the other kids are all Edith and Teddy's. And then she gets to be an adolescent. She's beautiful and she's headstrong and she's smoking and she's drinking and doing all sorts of things. But she has the great line about Teddy that he so wanted to be in the center of things that he wanted to be the bride at the wedding and the corpse at the funeral and the baby at the baptism. I mean, she knew how to say things.
That's terrific. And wasn't he once asked about how he could control her? What was that conversation?
Yeah, somebody
about?
Said to him, "Can't you control Alice because she's out there partying late at night?" He said, "I can do one of two things. I can be president or I can control Alice. I'm going to be president."
Isn't that a great line? I absolutely love it.
Can we get back to the incumbent for a second? Maybe you're right about. Do you have a relationship with Obama at all?
Yes. Well, I got to know him because he read Team of Rivals when he was running against Hillary. So one day on my cell phone, I picked it up and he said, "Hello, this is Barack Obama.
No.
I've just read Team of Rivals and we have to talk."
Now wait a second. Without a secretary saying the president is on the phone?
He wasn't the president. He was just running against Hillary, right?
Oh,
and he's way behind. So he's just a potential nominee, right? So it's like in the spring of 07. So he invited me down to the Senate office building, not to talk about putting Hillary in the cabinet like Lincoln had done, but rather he was so fascinated with Lincoln's emotional intelligence. So we talked about how he didn't retaliate against people who made him mad, how he didn't let feelings fester inside. And then what happened is when he gave Hillary the position of Secretary of State, everybody kept saying Team of Rivals. And then he asked me to put together over these last 4 years, we've had four historians dinners at the White House where we all go as like Truman and Robert Caro goes, LBJ and Meacham on Jackson or on Jefferson. And we just talk to him. You know, there's maybe 10 of us and a couple White House people. And they've really been fun. So
yet you would say, with the exception of Hillary, and that he's not a real team of rival kind of guy.
Well, the question again is, it's true. At the beginning, he had Hillary. He had Joe Biden, who had been they'd all been minor rivals except for Hillary.
Well, and also Biden made that, I would say, pretty offensive remark about him in the debate about being articulate and that sort of thing.
Yeah,
the
exactly.
Comment.
But he chooses him as vice president. Yeah. He was going to have Richardson in the cabinet. He had Vilsack who'd run against him. He tried to get Judd Gregg. And Judd Gregg, I talked to him later. I mean, he said that Obama treated him really well when he finally declined.
Former New Hampshire senator,
right,
for those that don't recall.
And he thought that it was too big of an ideological gap. I think the problem is the relationship between the parties is so bad right now that it seems traitorous for a Republican to, as we saw with John Huntsman when he ran for president, the fact that he'd been ambassador to China in an Obama administration was held against him. So the question is, could he have done more? Possibly, but it's also true that it's harder now than it was before.
Well, I want to ask you that, too. You get the sense from your books that certainly a lot of these presidents and even the people that were in the Senate then were men of somewhat more impressive character. There were really no women then. Is that true, or am I just rose-colored glasses?
No, I think it's probably true. I mean, I think, you know, eras create great people sometimes, and that's why it's fun for me to study the Civil War, World War II, or the Progressive Era, because they feel enlarged by knowing that they're dealing with the problems of their age. And you look at the people in Washington now, and they can't be feeling it's fun to wake up every day and just go and start yelling at each other and get nothing accomplished. So I wonder whether the best people are entering public life when they have these visions in front of them.
Yeah, well, I think that's a big problem, whether the best people are entering. I would guess that a lot of the best people are not. But the other thing is, it's a similar era in terms of this whole income inequality thing when we had played the clip before from Barack Obama. And the income inequality there and the changes that they made, the Depression came shortly after that. I mean, do you see any analogies between that income inequality in Teddy Roosevelt's day and Taft's day and ours and what's going to happen to us in the future?
I mean, I think one of the things that's created the income inequality this time is a parallel to the Industrial Revolution. It's our technological revolution, which has produced a whole different economy, billionaires side by side with ordinary people struggling. Unions have diminished in size and power. And the interesting thing is that you had, the 1920s led up to the Depression. And then World War II changed the economy once again. And we got a giant middle class for 25 years. It was full employment. People saved money that they could then spend in their suburban households. And the unions were stronger then. And there was an income tax that had been set in place with wage deductions. And then that's gone now. I mean, something happened, partially the technological revolution, partly the whole attitude toward government changed. Reagan created a generation of conservatives who believed government was the problem rather than the solution. So it's much harder now to figure out what what tools the president can use to deal with income inequality right now.
And the bully pulpit is obviously one of the few that he unilaterally has the power to use.
That's right.
What did you think of Bryan Cranston in All the Way? We talked about it only 3,000 times.
Oh, he came to our house and had dinner.
Oh, my God.
He is the best guy. I mean, he's just a one. And the playwright, Robert Schenken, came another night and had dinner with us.
Tell me you're a great cook, too, Doris.
No, we went out to dinner.
Oh, good. But okay.
First,
we
went through my husband's boxes for him because, you know, my husband was a speechwriter for LBJ, most importantly, also Kennedy, but he wrote all of the great civil rights speeches. And we found the drafts of the speeches for the We Shall Overcome speech and the Howard University speech. I was nearly in tears because we hadn't found them before to be able to show to Cranston and Schenken. So we're going to go down to the premiere in New York City. I thought it was like watching Daniel Day-Lewis, it was the LBJ. Both Dick and I knew. I thought it was a brilliant performance.
And you also say it's one of these things where, let me be naive for a second. Early in the presidency, I think it was when the Affordable Care Act was on the table and was unclear if there'd be enough votes and could he get a few Republican votes? As simple as, and this is long before I even though I'd read your book, I hadn't, obviously All the Way didn't exist. I would say to Marjorie on the air, call in one of the Republicans, say, excuse me, you know you don't like that federal government? Well, we'll stop all federal funds to your district and we'll make you happy. And by the way, this conversation never happened.
Exactly.
I mean, and that's sort of a lowbrow version of the brilliance of LBJ. He just doesn't have that thing.
I mean, LBJ was able to understand lowbrow, sanctions, promises, pledges.
Threats.
I mean, when he was trying to get Dirksen to bring the Republican minority along to break the filibuster on this 1964 Civil Rights Act to break segregation in the South. So it's a combination of promising him everything under the sun. Illinois would be sunk in all the projects. And he couldn't even do that today. It would be transparent. You know, public works projects, dams, schools, et cetera. But then he finally goes to Dirksen. He says, you know, Dirksen, you come with me on this bill. 200 years from now, school children will know only two names, Abraham Lincoln and Everett Dirksen. how can you beat that, right?
It's just unbelievable.
Do we have time for a couple more questions?
Yeah, of course we do.
I wasn't sure what time we had to go to. So I know you can't really judge someone contemporaneously. It has to go years from now. But just I do wonder if this Obamacare, Affordable Care Act gets straightened out and people have health insurance. It obviously is a big deal. When you look at his term so far, what he's done so far, that will be it, at least at this point.
I think it will be his signature legislation, as he himself has said, which is why if it doesn't get straightened out, if it doesn't work the way they thought, I think it'll be really hard. So much else was sacrificed for it. And it is a big deal. I mean, he'd be the first president in 100 years. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt tried to do it. FDR tried to do it. Truman tried to do it. JFK was hoping. And LBJ obviously got Medicare, which still will be a signature achievement for him. But it has to be straightened out quickly, I think, because otherwise there's still other legislation. Immigration reform might have been another signature act for him.
When you say might, though, CNN's John King joins us every Tuesday, and he says the best that's going to happen on immigration is this piecemeal thing, despite the fact that recent poll showed 60%+ of the public support a pathway to citizenship. Mitt Romney lost Latinos 71-29. I naively assume that Republicans know it's in their self-interest to do something serious on immigration, even if Obama gets credit. You don't think it's going to happen either?
I don't know. I mean, it just seems incomprehensible that it wouldn't happen. But it may well be just because the way the districts are now lined up, that you don't have to appeal to anybody in the country as a whole if it's just your own special interest in those districts.
Right.
And it may be that people are banking on the fact that, you know, it'll go away as an issue and something else will take its place. But it does seem its time has come. That's exactly what Dirksen said when he finally went for civil rights in 64. He said, it's an idea whose time has come. Immigration reform is an idea whose time has come, and somebody's going to get it done.
You know, if it comes, the only names we'll ever remember, Abraham Lincoln and John Boehner. Don't you agree? Hey, Doris, before you go, what's in the works? I mean, what are you doing?
Well, the only thing that I'm thinking about now is bringing all my presidents together, and because I don't want to be without one of them for a while, and studying what are the leadership traits that they shared. Because there really are five or six traits that Teddy, Lincoln, and FDR shared in particular.
We heard a rumor this morning, and from a pretty reliable source, Marjorie and I were at breakfast, that you were writing the definitive autobiography of Jacoby Ellsbury. You can say it here. Is there any truth to that? You're not upset at all that he's in New York, are you?
I am upset that he's
Why?
In New York. I mean, on the one hand, only because I loved watching him on the Bates Pass, and I thought he was a good player for us. But on the other hand, you know, they were right about everything these last couple of years, getting rid of Crawford, getting rid of Gonzalez, having a team like this team. I love this team this summer.
These castaways for
no,
short
I
money
love
was
them.
Incredible.
I mean, Johnny Gomes and Shane Victorino. I mean,
you should see the look on Doris Kearns Goodwin's face as she's saying these words, by the way.
What's the name of your book about the Red Sox?
Wait till next year. Well, finally, next year happened. No, yeah. And while I was finishing the book, I was so late. All summer long, I couldn't do anything else. I couldn't be on television because I wasn't reading the newspapers and I didn't know anything that was going on. I couldn't do lectures. I couldn't go on vacation, but I could read the sports pages. And every day almost, it seemed 97 days, they made me happy. So I promised myself, even if they lost in the fall, it would be okay. But then, of course, once they got into it and we were at all those World Series games, all the playoff games, it was the happiest time. It was just game six. Oh, my God. So in the other words, I'm going to trust their judgment. I'm sad to see Ellsbury go, but 7 years, who knows what will happen to him. And we'll get a lot of players in the meantime.
So you have a third World Series. You have a great new book, The Bully Pulpit, and Ron Burgundy's your lover. I mean,
and,
this woman is living the life.
Doris Kearns Goodwin's new book is The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. Up next, Harvard historian Nancy Kane joins us to talk about the latest economist to drill home the global reach on income inequality. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. It's deja vu all over again. Today, we're replaying interviews that we've had over the years. A couple of weeks ago, Harvard historian Nancy Kane joined us to talk about the latest book on income inequality. It's entitled Capital in the 21st Century by Thomas Piketty. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us in Studio 3, as she does every Tuesday for Open Mic, is Nancy Kane. Nancy's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, as you probably know, even though one is in the works now, is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hey, Nancy.
Hey, great to be here.
Thank you for coming in, Nancy. So income inequality is a big buzzword. You know, Pope Francis is talking about it, and Barack Obama is talking about it, and lots of us, we've talked about it many times. But now there's this new book by this new economist that's getting a load of buzz about the same subject. So fill us in, please.
So Thomas Piketty is a French economist. I make him to be in his early 40s, if I've done the backward math on it. He, very well trained, spent some time at MIT and, you know, has talked about that a little bit, what he learned by being in the new world, so to speak, or being in America, found his experience here to be a little, in academics, to be a little too devoid, I think, or a little too distant from real-world problems, and has spent what sounds like, I mean, I haven't read a lot about this, but what sounds like, you know, a decade assembling with Emmanuel Saez, who many of our listeners will know as a well-published and very knowledgeable, very credible economist of income and wealth inequality, who has an appointment at Berkeley, has spent a lot of time with Saez developing what sounds like a really, really important set of data around not just inequality in the United States, not just inequality in Europe, but inequality all over the world. And the data is data that's not just for the last 20 or 30 or 40 years, but goes way back. So he has come with the data assembled with Saez to a series of, I think, very powerful, thought-provoking, and what will stand as flagstone-like arguments or contentions about Inequality's Natural Tendencies in Capitalism. The name of the book, Thomas Piketty, P-I-C-K-E-T-T-Y, Harvard University Press. They moved the press date up, something academic presses rarely do because it's gotten so much traction with reviewers and economists and commentators on business and capitalism. They moved the release date up till March. It's just come out, 696 pages, count them. He has come to a series of very interesting conclusions. The title of the book is Capital in the 21st Century, and John Cassidy, who's reviewed it in a very interesting piece in The New Yorker, the most recent edition, you know, and others have commented on the kind of parallels between calling a book Capital and Marx's Das Kapital. And they both are, I believe, going to be, Marx's book is, but Piketty's work is going to be a kind of, you know, touchstone for how we think about the operations of global capitalism.
Why?
For many, many years to come. Because like Wealth of Nations, I put it in that camp very carefully, or David Ricardo, Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, or Ricardo's political Principles of Political Economy, published about 44 years after Smith's book in 1776. Like both those books, he's laying down a set of arguments about how capitalism works as a kind of organic, you know, machine, organic set of relationships. And he's doing something very interestingly distinct from Ricardo or Smith, but more akin to Marx, saying you can't really think about – you can't really divorce capitalism and what we get from the political – from political actions, from the relationship between politics and economy. You need to think about the workings of capitalism in the context of the old-fashioned word political economy. Very, very interesting. Very, you know, a lot of us would recognize that, the truth of that. But here's the real point. So the point of the book is capitalism has a bunch of different principles that we need to think about the way it works and consider this as its natural default drive. One of which is, and this moves strongly in contrast to the way many of us, politicians, policymakers, economists today have for at least 50 or 60 years thought about, maybe 70, thought about capitalism, and that is that left to its own devices, you know, incomes will tend over a certain stage of development to come together, to converge. He's saying exactly the opposite, that there are driving forces, not just today, but over the long run, that actually move incomes in opposite directions, that diverge, that create a rigid class of people. Think about, you know, the French Revolution, or think about old world society, a rigid class system in which a small group of people control the majority of the wealth and the income, and that contrary to the way most
of America in 2014.
Bingo. Right, okay. And he has his numbers that make your jaws drop. But we all we can recognize the truth of this. Let me just give you sprinkle this, you know, long winded explanation with a few of them, little breadcrumbs. In 2012, the top 1% of the income distribution collected 22.5% of the income. If you widen that to the top 10%, it's more than 45% of the income. Or to get even more shocking but true, 95% of the income growth since the beginning of the Great Recession through 2012, 95% has gone to the top 1%. So all that money, all that gold off the table went to the top 1%. So he's arguing that actually the 50 years or 40 years of income equality, of convergence between, say, roughly 1945 and 1975 was an aberration. An aberration. So
Because of depressions, wars, and
rebuilding,
those sort of things.
Yeah. Right?
And also, we had much, much higher tax rates.
And there, here we go. He's arguing, you leave this animal, this organism, this ecosystem alone, and you're going to create Marie Antoinette and everybody else all over again. Right? In modern day America, Europe, developing countries, China. His data show remarkable trends toward this effect after a certain stage of development in lots and lots of places. So absent government policy, absent progressive, intentional action, this is what we may end up with. And he says, isn't it ironic in the land of America, right, we're going to end up with Balzac's Pere Goriot, Jane Austen's tiny little group of, you know, wealthy aristocrats in Mansfield Park, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, you know, one of the things I've always found fascinating reading about the, you know, period of enormous growth in the United States, what is our tax rate now, like 33 or something like that?
Mid-30s, yeah, top rate.
And at the time of JFK, the rates on the most wealthy were up like close to 90%. Yep. I mean, it was like crazy. And they were very high during World War II as well. But yep. I can't – so was that a big deal?
He thinks that's a big deal. And in fact –
allowing the middle class to grow.
Well, yeah. And in redistributing income, which he says, left to its own devices, will default into divergence, right? So yes. And then one of the most controversial parts of the book is his call for a kind of global tax, right? A kind of global wealth tax. And he's got different kind of, you can double click on that in a sense in the book and learn and see alternatives to that. That is what, if you look at the firestorm of conversation around this, that not interesting enough, not his conclusions, not the raison d'etre of this book, not the highway along which the arguments and the data and the significance of what he's writing about travel. That's not getting tons and tons of controversy. What's getting controversy is his political, you know, his suggested political or policy solutions to this. I think
it's a non-solution, though. I mean,
it's a non-starter, right?
Exactly. I mean,
we can't agree on carbon emissions.
Exactly.
Right?
And his view as to why it's got to be a global progressive wealth tax is because, as most people who aren't economists know, that one of the ways the wealthy avoid progressive taxation is they transfer their assets to places that, if you want to go state to state, Florida, you go to New Hampshire, has no income tax. You go to Florida, which has no estate tax.
Right.
Or you go to another country.
Or you go to another country.
The whole notion is a global wealth tax would capture all this. But even he acknowledges it's beyond unlikely. And so what I say as a non-economist is, and when I was reading all this stuff about him, while it seems that he has great insight, and I obviously virtually everybody in your line of work thinks he has colossal insight –
said something very, very important on good data.
But if you don't have a solution that's plausible to this collection of good data, what have you added to the, not you, what has he added to the conversation?
So, so it's interesting that you say that, Jim, because I actually come at it from exactly the opposite standpoint. I think, boy, this guy has done his homework, and what an important moment for, you know, the kind of rarefied air of economic academics to jump into, you know, into our world conversation. So, here's what he's done. Here's the contribution. If you were at Harvard Business School, this is why you would give him a 1 for his class participation, because he has really, really strong evidence that this is happening and it will worsen. Now, you can quibble and argue and stack, you know, kind of poke that pig, if you will. But let me tell you, I don't think you're going to break the skin in a huge way. That in itself, it's a little bit like where we've arrived with climate change. It's getting harder and harder, right? Just look at the weather patterns to say climate change and global warming are some kind of, you know, fantasy made up by liberal tree huggers. So I think what he's done is contribute an enormous amount of credibility to the idea that we have a worsening, serious global issue. Very few people have assembled the kind of data and written with the kind of boldness, supported boldness, that Thomas Piketty has.
So your position is as long as we have a decent set of facts that people of different political views can agree upon, in theory,
we get a lot closer to policy, conversation, and solution.
Because the economists that would be drawn into this administration or around the world,
or Republican administrations, right?
Great Britain,
or the World Bank,
France.
Or the IMF.
Okay.
Exactly.
What might be coming from
exactly.
the same. Exactly. So what I don't understand about this, though, I apparently wrongly assumed that this income inequality thing was much worse. We always talk about how, you know, there was this great piece in the New York Times over the weekend talking about how back in the Gilded Age, John Pierpont Morgan was endorsing a 20-to-1 ratio between what the CEO made and what the worker made. And now we're up to 354 times the CEOs make 354 times what the worker made. So I wrongly thought this was fairly new. But what you're saying is it's not. It's just other government interventions kept it to be less dramatic.
Well, a combination of forces, right? I think equalized wealth and he's arguing this. I can't take any credit, right? Okay. A combination of forces, right? Everything from the demolition of Europe and the rebuilding there to, you know, a lot of wealth destroyed, right? A lot of wealthy people's wealth destroyed. Just think about art collections during the Second World War. A lot of different forces. Government action was one of those, and particularly in America. But I think that we don't have any real numbers on CEO to average worker pay. You know, we don't have them very far back at all. They only go back really reliably to the 1950s. But those numbers astoundingly diverge in that time, right? So 20-1 is the average large company's CEO pay to the average worker in the mid 1950s.
Yeah.
Right. By the 1980s, it's 200-1. By today, right, it's over 300-1.
Right.
There's one astounding statistic in the John Cassie Review. In 2011, Tim Cook took home $378 million in cash and stock-based compensation as the CEO of Apple. That was 6,258 times what the typical Apple worker made. So one of the very – stay with me on this. This is really important. It's Piketty's. It belongs completely to him, but it's really important. It's another way he's going to change the conversation. Mm-hmm. He argues that a huge amount of the wealth in America that has gone to the top 1% is not being generated by – you know, Oprah Winfrey making $77 million last year, which she did. Highest paid celebrity in America. I learned that because I just taught Oprah Winfrey in my leadership class. It's not being generated by that. It's actually being generated by CEO compensation. And then he made a huge percentage of it. 70% of that diversion of income going to the top 1%, he argues, is the C-suite. And that means it's boards of directors, it's compensation consultants, right? It's shareholders who don't have legal means to really challenge that and stop that railroad, that rail engine on the tracks. But then he says, isn't it ironic that we're doing that and we're somehow attributing superstar status to managers and corporate officers who by definition do things in a group? So it's very hard to attribute huge amounts of performance, even if performance-based compensation actually had legal and practical teeth, which we know it doesn't. There are lots of CEOs from lousily performing companies who are taking home a big pot of gold at the end of the week. He said, isn't it interesting that ironically we're giving these individuals who work in a group and who by definition do things in a group, we're singling them out and actually feeding the monster of massively diverging income inequality.
Let me throw a few things in.
So
this
that's
mix,
a
by the way.
Really important piece
yeah.
by
the
of
way,
this compensation, the compensation, you know, if you will, conversation we need to be looking at.
Now, even if Nancy Kane is right, and she knows a little bit more about this than I do, I would acknowledge.
She
even
does?
If she's
Jimmy,
right,
are
yeah,
you
it's
sure?
shocking. Even if it turns out she's right that operating, at least for most people, from the same set of data is a good start. We are so far away from dealing with any. By the way, Piketty, while he wants his global wealth tax that he admits is unlikely, thinks the solutions, and I use that term in quote, that are being advanced by governments like ours are going to accomplish virtually nothing. And let's talk about the current state of affairs. We have a proposal by the president that is going nowhere to raise the minimum wage to $10.10. And while people are fighting for that, the National Low Income Housing Coalition says to rent a modest apartment in this country and just break even and have all those expenses, you need $18.92 an hour to break even and have no money left over. Democrats and a few Republicans are fighting for almost roughly half that, and they're not going to achieve it. Number two, what I had forgotten about or never knew until Marjorie mentioned this piece that about the income gap that you two were talking about between the CEOs and their line workers is when you said before, we really don't know the most current data, Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School, about the ratio. One of the reasons
from the past. We don't know it from very far back.
We don't even know it from the current because this is what I didn't know. In the Dodd-Frank bill, there was a provision that would have forced American companies to disclose the ratio of the compensation of their CEO to the median compensation of their employees, which would give us the same kind of data that you're praising with Piketty, because
in,
at least
in
we know the facts.
Exactly.
Right,
SEC documents.
And what is Congress's response to the bill that they passed into law? To delay for 4 years the disclosure. Now, what does that mean? It means we're never going to see the information. When it comes close to 4 years, they'll delay it another 5 years. So even if we agree, Nancy Kane, that the data from Piketty is being celebrated from coast to coast and beyond, what's the breakthrough moment? Who is the breakthrough person? What's the breakthrough idea that's going to rally left, right, and middle to begin to solve this problem? Because most, you know, a lot of people, do they buy the notion that it even is a problem?
I don't think they do. We would have this conversation many times on our previous radio station about a guy like Tim Cook with 370.
Well, he's making a billion after that, right?
Yeah, oh, I don't know what he's making now.
I don't know what he made last year, but I gave you the figure.
$378 million. And something in me says that's really kind of gross, that this isn't something that we should laud or think is wonderful. I mean, what do you do after the first $50 million? You know, I think he can squeak by. But you get calls from people who say, this is a capitalist country. You
free
can make as much as you want. This is free enterprise, blah, 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 blah. It's so bizarre.
So I come out of – I've been at the Harvard Business School 21 years. It's a, you know, astounding place, you know, and it's not that we don't have our issues, but it's an astounding place, a crucible to kind of grow up as a historian. And again, I've said this before on the air. I think historians generally get better as we age, like wine, right, and spaghetti. Spaghetti sauce much better the second day.
The sauce,
or the fourth day, right? So, one of the things I think about when I think about a question like that, or your question, Jim, so I want to take Marjorie's first and come back to yours, is, look, we want to reward people to incentivize and to recognize, to incentivize them to do their best work, and that includes paying people to have responsibility for large organizations, you know, a healthy salary or healthy compensation, and we want to recognize what they've done. So, you know, no one is talking, at least in my worlds and the worlds that I read about some kind of cooperative arrangement for compensating, you know, executives, but it's about the magnitude. It's about the levels. We're not talking, you know, should we pay, you know, a CEO $10 million or should we pay them $3 million? We're talking about $378 million or $500 million or $80 million in the case of some CEOs where the company's stock price and market performance was much below expectation and shareholders and employees suffered. So we're talking about orders of magnitude. We're also talking about signaling. Right? What is the signal this sends to Americans and the rest of the world about what our economy and our corporate sector is really about? And then we're talking about something even more important than both of those, which is what is, think about the, you know, categorical imperative of Kant, right? Act only on things that you are prepared to see generalized, right? That was his idea about a kind of, you know, bedrock for morality. It's really interesting when you start thinking about it. Do we really want, I don't care how much wealth we have or don't have or aspire to have, do we, any of us, as Americans or as members of a global village, really want to live in a let-them-eat-cake society in which a very, very small number of people take a lot of the gold, most of the gold, 95% of the income growth of the gold. And I don't care whether you are the wealthiest person in this country. If you really are prepared to act on what that looks like in 20 years, your answer is no. It is no, because that is a society of increased suffering, of increased social instability.
Well, that's one of the reasons the Occupy movement, as short-lived as it
was
had
really
such resonance
it's
with
just
so
the
many
beginning.
People.
So here's the answer.
I hope it's just the beginning.
That's the lead into the answer to your question, Jim. So what's the breakthrough moment? I mean, why don't you ask, you know, Fred Shuttlesworth, who led the on-the-street organizations in Birmingham in 1963 against Bull Connor, they didn't know that was going to be the breakthrough moment. It was a breakthrough moment, right? Or some of those students in Greensboro who sat down. They'd been sitting down for a lot of years. Or ask Lincoln, was the Emancipation Proclamation going to change everything? He didn't know that. It was, but he didn't know that. These, or Robert Moses, who was a civil rights worker who went on to lead the Algebra Project out of Cambridge and has really changed the face of a lot of high school education, particularly for black minority students in America. The breakthrough moment is never something we can pinpoint. But until we really start lighting the kindling, we're never going to set it afire and get a breakthrough blaze. So we're beginning to do that here, and we need to do that because the answer to the question, do you really want to live and let them eat cake society, for almost everybody is no.
Nancy, you spend a lot of time in leadership courses and interviews you do with some pretty high-profile executives in this country. If you were talking to them and there was no tape recorder and you said this was off the record and you were to say to them, do you think the fact that Tim Cook makes whatever is 6,000 times what the median worker at Apple makes or the average American CEO makes 354 times at least what the average median worker in his or her corporation makes? Would they say yes to you?
I think most smart thinking, broad looking executives would say yes, it's gotten out of hand. Right.
They wouldn't say this is what we need to compete in the global work marketplace.
I don't think so. In a very candid, no, because why? Because what got these people in most cases, not all cases, but what got them to the place they have is the ability to see not just right now, but beyond and what it means not just for them, right, but for their customers or their continued market ability to market to lots of customers or their continued ability to hire well-trained workers. All those things, you know, are vulnerable when we get closer and closer to let them eat cake.
You know who should lead the movement, Nancy? Yeah, we're
she
looking
should lead
at
the
her.
Movement.
Exactly.
That's
I'd
right.
Follow.
I think Nancy
I'm
Kane
serious,
is our breakthrough
Nancy.
Moment right over there. Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. When we come back, TV newsman Dan Harris joins us to talk about finding peace after a very public panic attack. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we're rebroadcasting a collection of conversations we've had over the past year. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 is a TV journalist who's endured multi-year tour of duty covering wars in Afghanistan, the Palestinian territories, Iraq, Israel. But what may have been more life-changing was a very public panic attack on live TV. Dan Harris, NECN alum and co-host of Nightline, writes about the aftermath of this implosion, what caused it, and how he recovered from it. A new book, it's called 10% Happy. Now, Dan Harris, before we start, I want you to recite without looking the whole title of your soon-to-be number two on the New York Times bestseller list as of next week. I'll start you. 10% Happier. What's the rest?
How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, De-Stressed Without Losing Edge, and Found Self-Help That Actually Works. A True Story.
Well, it's close. How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Actually Works. A True Story. Dan, it's great to see you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
And I love the without losing your edge part, because I think a lot of people are afraid of losing their
edge.
Totally. But let's start. You left NECN. We're going to get to the book and the meditation, everything else. But you had a great career in Boston here at NECN. And then you had a super stratospheric career. What happened?
It was crazy what happened. First of all, can I just say that you guys play awesome music coming out of the break?
We have nothing to do with it.
I heard you were playing Spoon, which is one of my favorite indie rock bands. You guys don't look like you even know who Spoon is.
And you were correct on that count.
I have no idea.
I saw them play at the Middle East here in Cambridge
really?
When I was in Boston in my mid-20s. Yeah, one of my favorite bands. Anyway, sorry to
I hope
give you credit where you don't
that.
Deserve
He's
it.
Responsible but for that.
In
but
the
go
control
ahead.
Room, you guys
yes.
are cool. So I was 28 years old, and I got a call from – I was working at NECN, loving it, by the way. I was totally happy. And then I got a call from ABC News, and they said, we want to hire you. And I said, custodial work? And they had a overnight anchor shift available. And the guy who was doing it at the time was Anderson Cooper.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And it was this –
whatever happened to him, by the way?
He's doing all right. His career is quite fine. Anyway, so they asked me to come – interview for this job, which was this loose overnight show. But then by the time I got there, Anderson decided he didn't want to leave. And so they had to figure out something to do with me, and I ended up being able to fall into Peter Jennings' orbit and work for him.
That must have been pretty impressive. Peter Jennings and Diane Sawyer was there in the same kind of orbit. So you were a 28-year-old phenom, and you were working around the clock like a dog.
Yeah.
It got to you after a while.
Well, I think it was kind of like a cascading snowballing series of moronic decisions. Instead of sort of thoughtfully approaching this new opportunity, I just threw myself into it part of it was calculated and smart, but part of it was also a bit heedless. I just became a workaholic. And when 9/11 happened, I volunteered to go overseas for many years. And I was in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Middle East, Israel, Palestine. And when I came home from doing that, I got depressed. And it was a kind of funny sort of depression. It manifested in my body. I wasn't consciously aware of being depressed. I was having trouble getting out of bed, and I felt like flu-like symptoms all the time. And then I did something really stupid. Instead of dealing with it, I self-medicated with recreational drugs. And that raised the level of adrenaline in my brain, I later learned, and basically primed me to have a panic attack on national television.
And by the way, unfortunately, to grasp the depths of that day you call the most embarrassing day in your life, you really have to see it. But describe it to us. What happened? When it happened? What set you're on? What happened?
It was June of 2004. I was filling in as the newsreader on Good Morning America. That's the person who comes on once an hour and reads a series of headlines. And I'd done the job before, and so I was completely comfortable and really happy to be there. And Charlie Gibson and Diane Sawyer tossed it over to me, and I started reading. And very quickly, as I was reading the first story off the teleprompter, I was overtaken by this irresistible bolt of terror, and my heart started racing, my mouth dried up, and my lungs seized up, and I just couldn't breathe. And I soldiered through a couple stories until I just couldn't breathe anymore. And it's this kind of internal dialogue of what are you doing? Why are you so scared? You're blowing this. There are 5 million people watching. Get it together. And I couldn't.
And
so
you
I
threw
just
it back to them. And my favorite part, you mentioned this last night, you were on with me on TV. Even though Dan throws it back to the anchors, because the people in the control room is just discussing or a little bit behind, the video that comes up while he's having this panic attack in front of 5 million people is, what was it, Harry Potter video?
Yes.
I know.
I mean, oh my God.
I could have used his magic lightning stick in that moment.
So you had this panic attack and you did recover enough to do the 8 o'clock news, mm-hmm. as you talk about, but then you began this reassessment of yourself and this journey. So tell people.
No, before the journey, I want to do one thing because I've had this discussion with you. I asked you last night something, but I was really asking this for Marjorie. When Marjorie says, and this is not outing you in any way, when Marjorie writes a column that she thinks is subpar, mm-hmm. tell Dan what you say to me. And I basically channeled this last night.
When you walk across the newsroom, you feel like everybody's looking at you saying, what a jerk. She mm-hmm. really is terrible. I mm-hmm. want to get her a job. Mm-hmm. She doesn't know what she's doing.
And so,
kind of thing.
And, yeah. and I would say it's likely if 5 million people were not reading her column, I mean, and probably not focusing. So I don't understand. The part that I don't get, I get everything else. And your book is fabulous and funny and insightful, and we will get to your path to recovery or whatever you call it. How did you how did you continue that day and the next day without utter and total humiliation?
I was in a shame spiral. There's no question about it. I thought that everybody knew what I was a fraud, and I was never going to be allowed to do the news again, which is why I lied to everybody and said, I don't know what happened. It was no big deal. I didn't admit that I had had a panic attack. I didn't know at the time that it was the drugs that had caused it. And then I was able to get it together for the 8 o'clock news, amazing, yeah. and then I was fine the rest of the week. Although I was on the phone with my mom, who's a doctor here in Boston, and she very quickly got me connected with somebody to help me with underlying panic issues, et cetera, et cetera. So I was dealing with it sort of both on air and off air. But the other thing, here's the thing. We think other people care about us. In fact, everybody's the star of their own little movie, and they're stuck in their own movie. So they're mildly interested in our embarrassments, but they're not. You know, I angsted about putting out this book for years. You know, should I do this? Should I admit all this stuff? And I put it out, and the sun rose the next morning. It's not that big of a deal. People are kind of like, oh, he's human too.
Well, I think we all think we're frauds to a certain degree, don't
yes,
we? I mean,
of course.
So okay. Mom steps in, helps you out. But tell us your road from A to B in terms of getting to some of the very funny stuff you wrote about, the whole mindfulness meditation stuff. How'd you get there?
So a couple of things happened. First of all, I had two panic attacks. After the second one, which was much more mild but was definitely jarring for me, I went to see a shrink in New York who's like a premier expert in panic. And he asked me a series of questions, one of which was, do you do drugs? And I said, yeah. And he leaned back in his chair and said, mystery solved. That's what did it. And when I realized what an idiot I'd been, that I just jeopardized this career that I loved, I knew I had to make some changes. Simultaneously, around that time, Peter Jennings had assigned me to cover faith for ABC News. So I was kind of shoved reluctantly, because I grew up in a very secular home here in Boston. My parents are both doctors at Harvard. And so there was no – I had a bar mitzvah, but it was basically for the money. And
mine too.
Yeah,
that's both
there
of us.
You go. And I got shoved into this world of faith, and I marinated in that for several years until I stumbled on self-help, which I didn't know what to do with, but there were kind of nuggets of brilliance and self-help, but lots of baloney too. And then from there, I stumbled onto meditation.
Okay. And what kind of meditation did you stumble upon?
Look at the smile on her face, by the way. We know who the two meditators are in the room and who isn't. There's a huge smile on the face of meditator Marjorie. Go ahead, Dan Harris.
Although I have to say, you seem like a pretty jolly guy, even without the meditation.
I'm a pretty jolly guy. It's because it's the first. Oh, we missed 12:57.
We did.
Spring started, we promised, 4 minutes ago. I am so far from jolly. It's ridiculous.
Well,
thank you, Dan.
About the internal narrator, the voice that's in your head all the time, the ruminating. Constantly about the future and the past. I mean, Jim does a little ruminating, wouldn't you say, just from time to time?
He wouldn't be human if he didn't do
that. Yeah, we all do it. Mm-hmm. We all do it. But so tell people about how you stumbled upon, I guess you call it Buddhist meditation.
Yeah,
right?
it's Buddhist meditation, or I guess the secular version is sort of a Buddhist-derived meditation.
Yeah.
All of which, by the way, was pioneered right here in Massachusetts. It all started from a guy named Jon Kabat-Zinn, who was on a meditation retreat here in Massachusetts, and he was a molecular biologist in Worcester. He had trained at MIT. And he was on a Buddhist meditation retreat and developed a secular he said he had this flash of insight where he realized that people would be interested in meditation if they strip all this, you know, straight out of a fortune cookie lingo out of it. And
sacred space.
Yeah, sacred space.
Divine mother.
Thank you. Thank you. All of these expressions that drive me nuts.
Yeah.
And Jon Kabat-Zinn developed this secular version of Buddhist meditation. It's called mindfulness. And it's what I do. And it's what a lot of other people, executives and sports stars, are doing now. And they were able to test it in labs. And what they've found over time is that it changes your brain, changes your body and your brain. And the results
literally changes your brain.
At Harvard, there was a study done a couple of years ago. This study convinced my very skeptical mom to start meditating. They found that if short doses of daily meditation change the gray matter in your brain. They grow the gray matter in areas associated with self-awareness and compassion and shrink it in the area associated with stress. That's amazing. And that convinced me, an incredibly fidgety, very, very skeptical guy, to give it a shot.
Well, you talk about this all the time in your book, and I heard you on Jim's show last night, and with Emily as well, saying that people say, oh, I can't do that. I have monkey mind, as the Buddhists call it. My head's jumping around. But you have a monkey mind. Everybody has a monkey mind, right?
Welcome to the human condition.
Yeah.
I like to say, newsflash, you are not unique or special.
Yeah.
I hear it all the time from people saying to me, I could never do that. I'm too, you don't know, my mind is too busy.
That's right.
It's malarkey. I mean, that is everybody's mind. And meditation doesn't get easy over time. It is hard. You're wrestling your mind to the ground. It's like holding a live fish in your hands. And just like when you go to the gym, if you're doing it right, it's hard. It's the same with meditation. And I think 5 minutes a day will give you a completely different relationship to that inner narrator.
So get people started. For the cynics among us, you're looking
at
one.
Want me to teach you how to do it?
Yeah, teach it. Yes.
I can do it. The New York Times tech reporter had me do it in fewer characters than it takes to send a tweet.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm going to do it in a slightly longer version.
Okay.
You can do it standing up as you are right now, but mostly we do it sitting. Mm-hmm. You sit with your spine straight, and that's only important just because we don't want you to fall asleep. Close your eyes, and then you find the place in your body where the breath is the most prominent, usually your chest, belly, or nose. And you just try to focus on the feeling of the breath coming in and going out. You try to do this for a nanosecond, and your mind is going to wander a million times to what did I have for lunch? Why did I say that stupid thing to my boss? What am I going to wear tomorrow? And every time that happens, you catch yourself wandering, forgive yourself, bring your attention back to your breath. And when you do that, by the way, that's the end of the instructions. When you do that, that's breaking a lifetime of habit of walking around in a fog of fantasy about the future and memory about the past and being distracted, and you are building it's a bicep curl for your brain.
So when you just asked me to do that for a nanosecond, and literally a nanosecond while you were talking, I was into that space or whatever you guys call this thing. Does that expand? I mean, is it like anything else with exercise? You can run farther and faster over a period of time. Does that nanosecond become a second, then three seconds, then a minute where you can really shut things down? Does that happen?
I'm going to speak for myself, and then I'll let Marjorie weigh in on this. But in my experience, I have good days and I have bad days. Some days I can get into a rhythm where I really am focusing on the breath and not allowing too much discursive thought seep in. Mm-hmm. But most days, it's just a constant series of humiliation.
You know, we're talking with Dan Harris, his co-host of Nightline. The book is called 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Actually Works, A True Story. One of my favorite sections of your book is you talk about going on, I believe it was a 9-day.
10-day.
10-day, okay, I'm sorry, a 10-day silent retreat. and it was hysterical because, you know, you think to yourself, these people are all crazy. Mm-hmm. I'm crazy. Mm-hmm. What am I doing here? You hated it. And then you didn't hate it. So give people an idea what that was like. What, this 10 days, no silence, no eye contact, apparently, with some Jewish guy that came from New York City and had a big accent.
Yes.
He was the leader.
Joseph Goldstein, who has become one of my heroes. He actually runs a Buddhist meditation retreat center in Massachusetts, in Barre, Massachusetts.
Oh, the famous one.
Yes. He's one of the founders of that place. And I caught myself about 30 seconds into this retreat thinking, what am I doing here? I do not belong here. I should be on a beach with my wife. This is ridiculous. And I was surrounded by, you know, people who wear socks and sandals, which probably many of your listeners do. So I
God, we hope
that.
Not. And, we really hope not.
And I'm spending 12 hours a day or whatever it is trying to focus on my breath, which feels, when you do it for that length of time, irretrievably stupid. Just what am I doing? And it's really, really hard. And so at 3 or 4 days, something happened, and it was as if after being pulled by a motorboat by my head and underwater for 4 days, all of a sudden I got up on water skis, and I was able to see what was happening right then and there very clearly. So everything from the birds and the trees to the pain in my knee to hunger pangs. And that can be very exhilarating when you are dragged, kicking and screaming into the present moment in that way.
You know, Dan, you mentioned a minute ago that I think you said from executives to obviously anchors to whomever this works. What I don't think you mentioned is one of the things you've talked about is military people in the most stressful of circumstances. Mm-hmm. What's going on with it? Is this an experimental thing? Is it an ad hoc thing? What's happening?
This is the U.S. Marines and the U.S. Army are spending millions of dollars to test whether meditation can make more resilient warriors. So the motivation is largely this epidemic of PTSD, which is incredibly sad and doesn't get enough media attention. But it's also one of the things that they're finding, according to my friends who are doing the research, is that it's making better warriors. So there's been a hue and cry among some traditional Buddhists that you're making better baby killers, but what in fact they're finding is they're making less reactive troops who are less likely to start opening fire without thought and killing more babies and driving the local population into the hands of the insurgency. So what's fascinating to me is you have mindfulness now emerging as a counterinsurgency tool. Who would have thought?
And is it more likely that those better warriors come home healthier?
Yeah.
I don't mean just physically healthier, but less likely to be susceptible to PTSD and those sort of things?
Yes. What they're finding is that I was at Camp Pendleton with the Marines, and they had two groups of Marines. One going they were all going through a fake Afghan village and getting shot at, and bombs are going off. And what they were finding is the preliminary results is that it looks like the soldiers who were trained in meditation, their heart rate and stress rates were recovering faster. So it's not like they become zoned out, zenned out zombies. They react the way we all do. They just recover quickly. They don't go into that spiral that we all do of feeding the initial emotion with rumination.
Dan Harris is the co-host of Nightline. His book is 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Actually Works, a True Story. If the only associations you have with Ted Williams are cryogenics and the Ted Williams tunnel, writer Ben Bradley Jr. has written the most thorough biography of Williams to date. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we're rebroadcasting a collection of conversations we've had over the past year. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Now, if you think you know everything about baseball legend Ted Williams, chances are you don't, unless you've read The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams. Joining us in Studio 3 for the author of this new biography, I've read about 150 pages. It is spectacular. Ben Bradley Jr., thanks so much for joining us.
If a man could give birth, I feel like I'm giving birth to this book.
A large baby, we should say, by the way.
If I'd known how long this was going to take me, I'm not sure I would have undertaken it. But it's sort of the way these things go, you know. I interviewed 600-odd people. And one person leads to another, and it becomes a mosaic, a puzzle, and you feel like you're putting together all the pieces, and 800, nearly 800 pages. So it just took a while, and it finally, you know, Little Brown, my publisher, was very supportive. I was missing deadline after deadline. I expected to be sued for recovery of my advance, but no, and they seemed to like it. So we'll see. Fingers crossed.
But the thing is, you did, and this is a remarkable story. It's encouraging for all those reporters out there or aspiring reporters that try and try and try. Tell us about getting the daughters, Bobby Jo and Claudia, who had not spoken before, how long that took you.
Well, that was the key break. That was a pivotal moment in the book. That happened in 2004, and they'd been saying no to me for 2 or 3 years. And you know how reporters are, Marjorie. You have to have thick skin in this business.
Yeah.
You have to be. You don't have to mind if doors get slammed in your face. You persist, and I think finally they felt sorry for me. And just said, come on in.
So what'd you do? Did you call them, email them? Did you write
them
letters?
All of that.
All of that.
And with Bobby Jo, the older daughter, I ended up just showing up at her house, taking a chance. And her husband was outside raking leaves and, finally took me inside to meet his wife. And then once you have a foot in the door and things go well, have a cup of coffee, sure.
And that was it.
That was it.
Yeah,
so
that
you
was
think
it.
At
no
some
one else
point,
got them. No one else got them.
No.
You opened the book rather dramatically, I should say. It's not with his home run in his final at bat. It's not with his breaking into the major leagues. It's not with this great speech that I'm embarrassed to say nothing about when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame. We'll talk about it in a couple of minutes. It's when he did like an Anne Boleyn kind of thing, and his head comes. Were you worried, by the way, that he was going to come back to life by the time he finished writing the book? No. Tell people who, well, either read the excerpt in the Globe yesterday or your book. What's your first chapter about?
It's about cryonics, which is this fringe movement that believes that at some point medical science will advance to the point where it will be possible for you to be cured of whatever it is you died from and come back to life. And it's wildly improbable and subscribed to by several hundred eccentrics. And I visited there, and I signed you guys up for the procedure, by the way.
I was already on the list.
Thank you. That's right.
Listen to this just for a second. This is the introduction. About 30 people anxiously awaited the arrival of Ted Williams, the great Teddy Ballgame himself, American icon, last of the 400 hitters, war hero, world-class fisherman, perfectionist, enfant terrible. Yet this was no press conference, no card show, no charity event or meet and greet where Ted would wave and say a few words to the faithful, for he was dead, after all. Quite dead. How long did you struggle internally to decide if that's where you start this whole
journey? Well, I knew that right away. I wanted to, first of all, people's last memories of Williams were this dark cryonics affair. And second of all, I didn't want to, this is a long biography, I didn't want to start it in the conventional way. He was born in 1918, raised in San Diego. I get to that soon enough. I thought I would start with this cryonic scene, and I was able to get three people who were inside the room to talk to me to recreate that scene, and it's pretty vivid.
It is pretty vivid.
So, do you know, and what do you tell in your book about the decision to do this cryonics thing? Because that was very controversial. Did he really want it? Did he not want it? Was it his son John Henry's idea? What do you conclude?
Well, John Henry, the son, drove it. And Claudia told me, the daughter, for the first time, that Ted did accept this. And she said that the way they phrased it was that they asked him to do this for them, that they wanted it. And they saw this as a, however naive it might be, as a way to stay together for eternity, perhaps come back. And Ted was about a year away from his death. He was about to undergo a hospital procedure, and they went to him and had this moment. And she said, Dad, would you do this for us? And they say he agrees. But my conclusion is that if he did agree, he was not really of sound mind. And several people that he talked to after that moment told him that he wanted to be cremated, which is what he said in his will. So I think it's very much in doubt, and that the most of my reporting suggests that he did not want it.
By the way, that's the voice of Ben Bradley Jr., his book, which comes out tomorrow, correct?
Tomorrow.
How nervous are you?
I'm a little edgy.
It's called The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams. I want to talk about two sides of arguably the same coin, race. You write about early on about the anger, the legendary anger of Ted Williams. And I think you conclude that a great part of that comes from the shame he felt for having a mother who was Mexican, and the whole feeling that he couldn't have been who he was had people known that he was Mexican. And then the flip side is this speech in 1966 when he's inducted to the Hall of Fame, Baseball Hall of Fame, where he argues for the inclusion of Negro League stars. First, describe both if you can. And is there a connection between those two things in his head, do you think?
Well, his speech to Cooperstown, in which he called on the lords of the Hall of Fame, Cooperstown, to admit the old Negro League players, was a baldly political speech, a courageous speech, which actually didn't get much notice at the time, and only in sort of historical revisionism has it been appreciated. But he was very popular for the with the black players. And
why'd he do it?
Well, I think he believed in fairness. And his growing up Mexican-American fascinated me. That was a little fact that wasn't widely known, became known really just a month before he died. And his mother was Mexican. And he had all these relatives out there, most of them based in Santa Barbara. He sort of disparagingly referred to them as the Mexicans and didn't want much to do with them. There was this great story in 1939. He came back to San Diego after winning the having such a marvelous rookie season here. And there was a big gaggle of the Mexican, extended Mexican clan waiting for him at the train station. And he took one look at them and beat it the other direction.
Never
didn't want to be seen with
them.
No, didn't want to be seen with them. And he wasn't ashamed so much of being Mexican as he was ashamed of his upbringing, and his mother was Salvation
yeah.
Army. The mother was the Salvation Army zealot, known as Salvation May. And she would be up to all hours of the night saving souls on the streets of Depression-era San Diego. And she tried to get Ted interested and made him march in the Salvation Army parades and beat the bass drum. Can't you see it?
No, I can't see it.
And it drove him wild. And this mother, he and his younger brother were some of the original latchkey kids. They were up until 10 or 11 at night waiting for their mother to come home. And luckily there was a ballpark down the street where Ted would be playing baseball. And the father was ne'er-do-well, drunk, and not involved. And so these kids had a tough life.
You also mentioned that I did not know either about the fact that a lot of people knew that Ted Williams served in the service. He was in World War II in Korea, but that he sought deferments. What was that about?
Well, it was at least in World War II, a highly patriotic time when people were rushing to enlist. He played all of the 1942 season after Pearl Harbor. The Red Sox were nervous about it, and they thought it was kind of untenable. And he was getting anonymous letters, like a sheet of yellow paper, accusing of being yellow. And he got what was called a 3A deferment. He was the sole supporter of his mother. By that time, the parents had divorced. And it was legal, and he was within his rights. And he wanted to make his dough, and he went on to win the Triple Crown that year. But finally, he could just see which way the wind was blowing. And so the summer of 42, he cut a deal with the Navy that he would enlist, but they let him play out the 42 season. And then, so he served 3 years in World War II as an instructor. He's a Marine fighter pilot, top
yep.
gun. I mean, the real deal. The idea of a modern superstar athlete fighting in not just one war, but two, is just untenable. Can you see A-Rod in Iraq or Afghanistan?
No.
I mean,
no.
It's
Hey, when you spend 10 years with somebody, which you really did, do you feel like you know – I don't mean you know about them. Obviously, you know more about them, I bet, than probably anybody on the planet. Do you feel you know him? Are there moments when you're sitting at home in your house in your easy chair? I mean this sincerely. When you think Ted's my buddy, you know what I'm trying to say?
I feel I know him. I do feel I know him, and he was a figure in my life. You know, I'm old enough that I saw this guy play the last 3 or 4 years.
Don't
of
you have a
career.
Ball or something? Or
I got a ball.
Did that make a difference? By the way,
did you actually
physically saw him and touched him, and he signed a ball.
It was like a prop for me.
He signed a ball for me. He plays baseball, and his son plays baseball in college. You're a big baseball guy.
He meaning Ben Bradley Jr.
Ben Bradley Jr., yes. That's right.
When I was one of the millions of screaming kids around Boston at the time who looked up to this guy, and one day I'm out in the Players parking lot waiting for Ted to come out. Some days he'd sign, other days he didn't. There was this mob scene, and he made us all line up, and I got my autograph, and I didn't keep it in one of these glass cases, so the ink is fading badly after 50 years. But every once in a while, during this writing process, and I would look at that ball for inspiration on the days it wasn't exactly flowing, which were many. And it was a nice thing to have.
You know, you have a story later on in the book about his older years where it seems like he was just as controlling in many ways as he was before. Yes, right, Jim, we only have a minute left. But the story about the guy coming to fish with him and how he wouldn't let him go fishing the first day to sit in the bank and watch Ted fish. I mean, that was a little weird.
Yeah, which one is this? Again, remind me.
This is a story about Ted, big fisherman.
Yeah.
He invites a guy up to his camp to go fishing.
Oh, yes.
But the guy is not allowed to fish initially.
Yeah.
He has to watch Ted fish. I mean, that's pretty damn weird.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he was a perfectionist, and this guy was an accomplished fisherman, but a bass fisherman from Florida. And this was the raging rapids of the Miramichi River in Nova Scotia, specialized fishing. And the guy had bought a fancy rod, and Ted dismissed it as, a bunch of junk and insisted that he use his own rod. And then the guy tripped and fell and almost got swept away. But Ted, he was a perfectionist.
Yeah, about everything, even in his older years.
Yeah.
We were speaking with writer Ben Bradley Jr. about his new book, The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Our production crew is Chelsea Murs, Will Roslip, and Amanda McGowan. Alan Mattis and John Parker are our engineers. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio.